Hello to everyone out there listening, and welcome to the first season of our brand new Create podcast. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring the world of the creative industries, the fastest growing industry in the UK today. We're going to be chatting to people within the industry, routes they took to where they are today, and how our education system can keep up with this rapidly growing market. Over the course of the next few weeks, we're going to be speaking with people worldwide and try to see what other countries are doing to achieve the same goal. But before we begin, we would like to pay a special thanks to our sponsors, Firstport, for making all of this possible. We look forward to working together over the coming weeks ahead. Welcome to the Create Podcast. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Create Podcast. You're very welcome to episode 2, and thank you all for your extremely positive comments and feedback after our chat last week in episode 1 with Glasgow film director Doug King. Colm Keegan here, and if you're tuning in with us for the first time, we're releasing a new episode in this series every Thursday between now and Christmas. And we have some really, really exciting guests on board, ready to talk about their creative journeys in the hope that we might inspire any listener, young or old, on their own creative paths. If you want to receive a notification whenever our new episode goes live, make sure to subscribe to Broad Talent on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. Today, we are extremely excited to welcome this man to the show. Well, we're joined here in Broad Talent headquarters with Darren and Lydia, and we're having a bit of a party ourselves, getting into the zone and to the mood of the episode by listening to Belle and Sebastian. How are you doing, Darren and Lydia?
Doing well.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Colm.
I hope you're as excited as I am about the episode ahead and the chat with Stuart Murdoch. It's been something we've been looking forward to for a while. And the podcast series so far has been going absolutely brilliantly. I mean, looking at we've got a chart online of where everyone is joining us from. And it's amazing. We're being listened to across the world in the States, across the United Kingdom and Canada, Ireland, Australia, Netherlands, Brazil, France, Austria, Belgium, and many more countries. So it's unbelievable to think of how many people across the world are listening to us. So to everyone tuning in, thank you very much. And to everyone sharing, thank you very much. Lydia, if anyone is tuning in to an episode and they want to find out who Broad Talent is and what we're all about, I know we kind of allude to it a little bit in the pilot episode, but can you give us a little bit of a summary of who we are and what typical work we do outside of podcasting?
Yeah, Broad Talent is a Scottish social enterprise, and we run creative workshops for young people, helping them engage with the creative industries, helping to inspire them and give them the tools and confidence they need if they want to go and pursue careers in these fields. We're particularly passionate about working with young people from deprived areas and helping create opportunities that otherwise they might not be exposed to.
Which pretty much describes us in a nutshell. So thanks for that, Lydia. And as I said, if anyone wants to find out a little bit more about us, you can either visit us online, check out our website, or check us out on social media, or you can listen on the podcast to our pilot episode where we talk in a bit more depth about some of the projects that we've done in the past. But one of the questions we're being asked a lot on social media at the minute, and I thought I would turn this question to the Scott of the group here to answer, but it's what does the word bra mean? So Darren, as the Scott here with us, can you explain to the listeners what does the word bra mean?
Yeah, so bra is just that kind of old Scottish word for good, for brilliant. So for example, if it's a nice sunny day, which I know doesn't happen very often here in Scotland, we would say it's a bra day. The weather's bra if it's nice and sunny.
It's so rare to happen in Scotland that they had to come up with a word to try and describe it. So yeah. And then if anyone wants to get in touch with us, Darren, where can they go to reach out to Broad Talent?
Yes, so people can get in touch with us on social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. They can get in touch via the website. We've got a newsletter. Sign up on the website as well that they can put their details into. So lots of ways to get in touch, emails as well.
As always, Darren and Lydia, thanks a million for stopping by. Our guest today is Glasgow's Stuart Murdoch. lead singer and songwriter of indie group Bell and Sebastian. It was an absolute pleasure to have Stuart agree to chat with us on the podcast, and in today's episode, we talk about growing up in Scotland, early steps that were taken when starting a career in music, and the multiple challenges that had to be faced when doing so. We talk about his role as director of musical drama God Help the Girl, as well as current and upcoming projects. It was a real pleasure to welcome Stuart Murdoch to the Create Podcast. Stuart Murdoch, thank you so much for taking the time out and to join Broad Talent here for the Create Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on board.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Colm. Thanks.
Before we start, Stuart, how's everything going at the minute? Have you been in touch with the other guys from the band?
Well, the funny thing is I haven't seen the band very much at all, you know, because back in March, we were meant to be going to California to make a new record, and our plans instantly changed. And then they just kind of disappeared. You know, I guess there's a lot of young kids, a lot of the band have had children, and as you can guess, during the lockdown, that was a bit of a handful. So, yeah.
Amongst all of that, you've still been able to get around to releasing a double album, which is going to be coming out in December. So, was that something that was pre-planned before all of this? Was that in the pipeline that you wanted to try and get this album out?
It wasn't meant to be so fancy. It was going to be a Spotify playlist because of the shows that we played last year, and we kind of tracked them up. But with this sort of enforced little hiatus, we thought actually this is a good time to go to town on it, to make the mixes really nice, to do visuals for all the tracks, and actually make it a double vinyl LP, do all the artwork, all that kind of stuff. Oh, it was brilliant. Fun to do. I can imagine.
Just to have something to aim towards, you know. And from a listener's point of view as well, I know so many people are just looking for something to get excited about again.
Yeah, it was like a little bit of a consolation for not doing anything this year.
Yeah, yeah, of course. So that's the double album, which is going to be released on December 11th, entitled What to Look For in Summers. And Stuart, it's a collection of songs live from Bell and Sebastian's 2019 World Tour. We're looking forward to getting our hands on a copy whenever it's available. And you have very kindly allowed, just for our listeners, a bit of a preview, a sneak peek from the album before it goes on sale. So at the end of this chat, we're going to wrap up by giving the listeners a preview of the latest version of The Boy with the Arab Strap. So thank you very much for that, sir. What Broad Talent is all about is running creative projects in schools and community centres, especially with younger listeners and young people that we work with. And when we've got someone of your success that you've had throughout the years with Bell and Sebastian, you know, there's so many questions that we want to ask, and hopefully we will get time to ask. But before any of that, what I would love to do is go right back to the origin of it all. What was it like for you growing up in Glasgow? Was there any local musical inspirations for you? And what sort of childhood memories would you have? Would they be fond memories?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I was into everything. I was just regular. You know, I was into football as much as I was music. I used to sit on, we had a swing in our back garden, which sounds quite posh, but, and I used to sit on the swing and sing the top 10 of the day, like go down the top 10. That's one of my earliest kind of memories of being just totally into pop music, you know, when I was 6 years old.
Wow. As a child, were you sure in your mind that you wanted to be a singer? Was music a passion from a very young age?
Yeah, I was into music, but in a lot of ways, but it never occurred to me that it could be a career. Like even way, way later on, I was never, it was almost by accident that it became my job, so to speak. Music was just all around. My mum always sang in choirs, and my gran used to conduct the Glasgow Ladies Choir for the Socialist Church or something like that.
Wow!
Yeah, my uncle Duncan, he conducted a choir as well. So there was a lot of music, especially on my mum's side.
Okay, so you were definitely surrounded by it then growing up. And in terms of what you were listening to, obviously, if you were singing the top 10 in the charts, you were a big fan of what was on the radio. Any bands in particular that you would have a soft spot for or yeah, posters well, we, of on your wall?
Yeah, we mostly had the, you know, we mostly had the radio and when we were younger, me and my brother, we were kind of by default, we got into this stuff my sister was sort of into, which is, it started off being the Osmonds and then progressed through ABBA to Queen.
Oh yeah,
and
the classics.
Yeah, but then it got, you know, then it got better, Stevie Wonder and David Bowie and the Blondie towards the end of the 70s. It's just a great mix. It was a really nice time that, you know, the late 70s, it was such a great mix of sort of punk coming through and
of course,
soul
yeah.
music and disco as well.
So then in terms of musical instruments, how old were you when you started learning piano and was there any other instrument that you learned?
Yeah, so I was 6 or 7, I think, maybe. Okay. Yeah, because I'd moved out of Glasgow down to the seaside, a town called Ayr, and started playing the piano when I was 7, got lessons. Then I picked up the violin for a short period and I didn't like that.
Oh, really?
And then, yeah, I didn't. My violin teacher really didn't like me, the fellow in the school, you know. So I switched to trumpet pretty soon after. So I was trumpet and piano.
Okay. And in terms of playing the instruments then growing up, were you somebody that couldn't wait to sit down and play the piano or the trumpet, or was it a bit of a chore having to sit down and do the practicing?
It was a mixed bag. It's funny looking back for a young scrappy guy who was into football, you almost didn't want to admit that you enjoyed playing the piano, but when you look back, you did have these hours with the master, so to speak. That was the name of one of the books, Hours with the Masters.
Oh, right.
Beethoven and Bach. But it was I'm so glad that I did have that time. I really did. When I got down to it, I enjoyed playing the pieces. I didn't enjoy the scales or the theory or the sight reading so much.
Yeah, I'm always interested to hear other people's perspective on it, because I know from my perspective, practicing the piano or any of the instruments that we played growing up was in my head, if I'm totally honest, it was a second. Every second that I sat down at the piano was a second off the football pitch. You know, it was not something that I would have raced in to sit down and do the practicing. But in later years, it's something that I regularly thank my parents for sticking at me for playing the piano, because, you know, it's my bread and butter now. So I would be incredibly grateful for the ability to play the piano now when I probably wouldn't have been able to see that growing up.
Totally.
So then moving into school, Stuart, was there any extracurricular activities that you took part in, or was there any teacher that could spot this young talent and help nurture it?
Yeah, we did okay in the primary school. We were lucky. We had in our last year of primary school, Mrs. Stewart, who was our class teacher, was also the teacher of the school choir, and we had a pretty good choir in the school. And we used to enter the Ayr Music Festival, which was, you know, a pretty big one, quite prestigious, in the Ayr Town Hall, and so we used to win the choir, and I sang solo as well in a couple of competitions and played my piano, you know, so there was a lot of music going on. It was encouraged by the school. By the time you went to the big school, secondary school, it was quite a big, rough, tough school. You know what it's like, that change when you you go to, I mean, it was like 2,000 kids, and there was, you know, when you, there was men, there was boys walking around and looked like men. You maybe didn't want to advertise on day one that you were a budding virtuoso.
You certainly had to suss out the environment before you you choose your words carefully. Yeah. So moving into secondary school then, was there any bands that were set up during your time in secondary school, or was there any school shows that you were involved in, or, you know, what was it like then for those years?
Yeah, absolutely. That loomed large in our time there, especially the first couple of years. There was a school show, and our school class decided to put a little band together, especially for the Christmas show. And our house was called Kintyre. And so we were the Kintyre Keynotes. And I played the piano, and we mostly played Beatles, you know, Beatles covers and a couple of pop tunes from the from the charts. And funnily enough, if you see a picture of the Kintara Keynotes, I don't know why you would see a picture of the Kintara Keynotes. I do have one, and it I laugh because it pretty much looks like the lineup of Belle and Sebastian, just kind of in miniature. It's the same mix of girls and guys, strings and acoustic guitars. It's funny. It's the same number of people as well, you know. And
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Is that purely coincidental, or is that something that maybe, you know, you got used to that sort of environment?
It was just a fluke.
Okay.
Because that all kind of ended when I was 12 or 13. And then everybody seemed to kind of grow up and get a little bit more cynical. You know, puberty got around and nobody was really interested in playing Beatles songs anymore. And so that all that stuff got left behind for years and years.
That's funny, though. Was there anyone years later from the original Kintyre Keynotes knocking on your door looking for a job back then, and when Belle and Sebastian was touring the world?
No, I'm still pally with a couple of people in the group. And my friend Brian, who played guitar, comes along to the concerts whenever we're in Edinburgh. And Jennifer, who played violin, but they missed the... Yeah, they missed it when I was putting the group together. They missed the call.
That was their big job. So, Stuart, like, can you remember? Was there a pinpoint moment that you can remember where you just thought, "Okay, this is my career. This is my path that I want to take in music." Was there anything that happened, or was it just a natural progression of events?
Well, for me, without wanting to sound kind of morbid, I got sick at the end of my teens, and I sort of took a complete left turn from all the kind of things that I was pursuing. Although I was very interested in music before that, and I was, you know, I was a DJ in clubs and I was roadieing. But after I got sick, I actually discovered that for the first time that I could write a song, and so that very quickly became something that I clung on to. And from that point onwards, I wasn't sure it was ever going to be my job, but I knew it was the great passion that I had.
That's amazing. I mean, did I read correctly that you were saying before that it wasn't until your mid-20s that you wrote your first song?
Yeah, it was. Maybe early 20s, because I got...
Early 20s.
Yeah, early 20s. So I was a late developer.
Did you feel that because of what you'd been through that you now had something to talk about or a story to tell, or you know, do you think that in some way it was connected to the years that led it up beforehand?
Yes, absolutely. I felt a need to sort of communicate my precipitous situation. But also I just something just must have clicked, because I just remember sitting down one time at the piano and feeling, having this feeling that I wanted to say something that was that I maybe couldn't have put across in a letter, or I maybe couldn't have put across by word. It was a feeling. And so I sat down at the piano and wrote a very simple song, but then I thought, wow, that I did that, and you know, maybe I could do more of that.
It's a fascinating way into the songwriting experience. And so now you're writing songs. You've had a really difficult few years, which seems to be behind you at this stage. And are you running 100 miles an hour at this new world of music? Is this what you want to do? I mean, what are the steps between Stuart Murdoch, the songwriter, and setting up something like Belle and Sebastian?
Yeah, it was an interesting time. It's funny because I'm starting to do a bit of writing. I could probably write a whole book about that period of trying and failing to get a band together. I maybe was in two or three different funny ensembles. But I think I appeared too desperate. You know, I was writing a lot of music and I had I really wanted to get it across, but I guess, I still struggled with my health and, you know, so people kind of took me the wrong way and I couldn't really keep up with them energy wise. And so it was a funny time and, a lot of trying and failing and actually by the time, I'd actually taken a risk with a friend. We'd gone to America to actually look for warmer climates and to, you know, to try and feel better from our ailments. And I was thinking about staying in America because I didn't feel there was anything happening in Scotland.
And was that more to do with the climate and getting over for health reasons, or was that to do with the culture of music?
Aside from the climate, that was what drew us there, but it sort of changed. It changed our lives, actually. My friend Michael and I, Michael was another musician, and he happened to have ME, the same thing that I had. Going to America, it went to California, and it really opened things up for us. People were very open and encouraging in the States in a way that Scotland in the 90s really wasn't. And, no criticism. It's just a difference in culture where you could be a songwriter or you.
Sure.
There was a feeling, people, whereas in Scotland at that time, it seemed to be a slightly ridiculous thing to aspire to. I think things have changed a lot.
So it seems.
In 20 or 30 years because Glasgow subsequently became Music City and people came to Glasgow to be in bands and it became a recognized.
I find that really interesting when you're talking about that, because my whole perception of Glasgow, even before I lived here, was always that it was a really great music hub, that it just produced and had such a music culture. So it's really interesting to hear your take on it from being here at that time, that you wouldn't have found that or probably was before that culture even existed then in the city.
And I think also as well, it's probably quite a lot to do with the type of music that I was aspiring to or what I was producing. It was a very quiet music. It was a delicate music. It looked back, it was quite poetic, and it looked back to the 60s. So even when I tried to do gigs, the engineers or the people that were helping me out, they really didn't understand they weren't so accommodating. And then also the people I was trying to play with. It took me a long while to find the right people to play with.
I love that you're talking about this, Stuart. I really do, because I think in today's day and age, I think there's a perception sometimes by programs that are out there to promote music. And I think anything that does promote music and promotes people, especially younger people, to get involved in music is terrific. And I certainly wouldn't be bashing it. But programs like X Factor or, Britain's Got Talent or Glee or, these programs that make things look on the outside like they happen very quickly. They want to sing a song and people are brilliant singers and brilliant musicians straight away. But, from listening to someone like yourself, who from the outside looking in is such a success story, to hear you talk about the struggles that you went through to make it work and the difficulties and the failures, as the term you mentioned, I think it's a really powerful message for anyone to sit back and listen to.
Sure. And even when the group got together for the first 3 or 4 years, we're always proving ourselves. You're always, you're only as good as the next song you write, really. Nobody kind of, I'm not sure. I think it's so important for people to stick to their guns, stick to what they feel that they're good at, because once you establish an idea, or once you establish yourself or your group, and you actually have a core following, then people can't really put you down at that point. It doesn't matter what the critics or what your mom and dad or what anybody says. Yeah. Nobody, you have this thing.
Yeah.
And that's a really important thing to find.
I couldn't agree more. I just think that's a message that I've been saying for years, especially in classrooms when you hear young singers and the singers are trying to sound like someone else instead of just trying to focus on what makes them unique. Because I as a listener, I'm always more interested about people who are different and unique rather than someone who's trying to be someone else. So I love that you're saying this as well. But on the topic of just when you mentioned a target audience there, which is something that any musician, young or old, aspires to have and dreams of having, after reading a few autobiographies of various musicians, and a few of them say they had a fire in the belly up until the day that they had a target audience, and then after that, a little bit of complacency kicked in because they knew that they could throw something out there and it was going to get X amount of record sales regardless. Did that ever kick in with you? Did you ever feel that complacency was an issue, or are you still as motivated today as you were when the band was first set up?
Yes, personally speaking, I am, and I'm very lucky in that after 24, 25 years of having this same group of people together, we are absolutely committed, excited, challenged, all that kind of stuff, about so excited about making a new record. And we still have, I feel that we still have so much to prove in some sense, but it always comes down to, you know, you can talk about record sales or how many people show up at your concerts. You can talk, but when it comes down to it, you forget all that when you're actually making music, when you're writing songs, when you're making the music, that takes over. That comes first.
You're just in the zone.
Yeah, there's no complacency there. There never could be, and you're never, you know, because you're making, you have this chance always to make something new. It's that feeling of creating something that keeps you going.
So can you take us back to the origin of the group being set up? So 1995, 1996, they were the years Bella Sebastian were set up. What were the processes that led to the group being set up? And did it feel from day one like this is just something really, really special?
So it was the beginning of 1996, right at the start of 96, although, you know, there was a bit of stuff in 95 as well. And yes, it felt very special, very auspicious, because like I said before, I'd had a few trials and a few failures with different groups, ensembles. But sure. This, what happened was that after I had sort of failed with different groups, I decided to go, I was doing a music course, like I was on the dole, and they sent you along to a music studio, and I would go there every day and work on the computers myself and just like kind of eke out a studio time to record demos. So there was a college in Glasgow called Stowe College. That was the music business college.
Yeah.
And they somehow got hold of a tape of my songs and decided that they wanted to make a record of those songs, because they made a record every year.
All right.
And they used a different band or an artist as a sort of guinea pig to be a so-called pretend record label.
Right. And you were the band that were chosen that year.
So I was, my songs were chosen. I had a friend, Stuart David, and he was on the music course I was on, and he had helped me with the demos. But aside from that, I needed a group to record the songs, and most of which hadn't, you know, been recorded or even played before. And so it was a.
And was the onus on you to find the group? Did they have any sort of? Did they have any suggestions on who you should contact? Were you left to your own devices to make that happen?
It was very much me, and I wouldn't have had it any other way. But the weird thing is that's why I was saying it was auspicious, because I had this opportunity that, you know, suddenly I could see it in front of me. There was I had this opportunity to go into a proper studio and make an LP record. And people just started coming out of the woodwork. It was really weird the way that, you know, because Richard, the drummer, happened to be in the music business class, and he just seemed to turn up. You know, he just used to kind of hang around, and and he used to come to the Halt Bar, and you know, where I used to get up at the open mic. And then the key person was Stevie Jackson, the guitar player for Belle and Sebastian, because he was the host of the open mic at Halt Bar on Woodlands Road.
Yeah.
And he was the one person that I had my eye on. And it felt like, because I had this opportunity to make a record, I had an opportunity to approach him and say, could you help me out with this record?
And so was that the moment? Was everything now in place for Belle and Sebastian after that? Or was there still a chunk of work to do before the finished article was formed?
Well, certainly a lot happened in 1996. That was
the big year.
That was it. At the start of 96, I didn't have a group. I didn't have anything.
Wow.
But that was when they asked me to make that record. By March of 96, there was, you know, I had gathered these seven people together and we made our first record. And then because we had something happened when we were making that record, it felt like we became a group.
Yeah.
We found the sound and I persuaded them to stick together and make another record in August, because by that time we had an offer from a record label, an independent label in London.
Brilliant.
to make a second record. So we made two LPs that year and we ended up in New York. And this for people that, you know, most of the group hadn't even been abroad before.
Well, talk about some learning curve.
There we were.
Yeah. Did you roll with the punches pretty well? Could you take it all and get excited by it? Or were you thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be found out here? Or, you know, what way were you thinking at the start?
I was pretty level headed. You have to understand that I'd been waiting to get this group together for so long. To me, the precious thing was the group and the other thing was the music. So I was just, I had my hands completely full, just nurturing this young group, because some of the, you know, Isabel and Chris were really young, and just trying to keep them together, trying to keep the personalities, trying not to let the whole experience overwhelm them.
Sure.
And focus on, I was writing a lot and, just making the music. So that was it.
That was it. Yeah. In terms of your songwriting then at that stage, how confident did you feel about it? You know, were you churning them out quite regularly at this point? What did you feel that this was a muscle that you were pretty well tapped into? Or did you feel in some way daunted by the prospect of having to churn out a lot of music?
I think by the middle of 1995, that's when I sort of, that's when I started writing better songs. I remember writing a song called Dog on Wheels and The State I'm In, and a song called Lord Anthony. I wrote them within, you know, about 3 or 4 days of each other, just in the summer of 95. And I felt like I'd stepped up a level, and that certainly continued all the way through 96. It's not like I had the songs for those first two records for that long. They were all actually pretty fresh.
And did you ever feel pressure as the songwriter of the group? Did you feel there was a bit more expectation on your shoulders, or was that a role that you were pretty comfortable with?
For that point, and pretty much for the lifetime of the group, the pressure's mostly been coming from me, going in the other direction. It's like,
okay,
I want to record faster, I want to record better, I want to record more. I always had lots of songs. And,
brilliant.
You know, but then, you know, after a couple of years, I realized, you know, that it would be great to hear other people's songs as well. And that actually took if there was pressure on me, which I didn't really feel it, but it took the pressure off me anyway. And that was a nice kind of development.
Because I remember reading this article years ago. They were talking about Billy Joel as a songwriter, and he was saying at one stage, I think the label was on his back and he had to deliver a big hit, and he hired out this really expensive apartment overlooking Central Park, and he had this really nice piano there, was all facing a certain way, and he turned out Just the Way You Are. So a few years later, it came to a stage where he was in a similar position. The label was putting pressure on him, so he hired the same apartment, had everything, including the same pen that he had when he wrote it, and he just couldn't do anything. You know, it just wasn't really coming to him. You know, is there ever that frustration that you find where it, like, does it happen quickly for you, or is there sometimes where no matter how hard you try, just you can't square the circle?
Well, do you know, that situation that you described with Billy Joel, let's not kid ourselves. We, Belle and Sebastian, have done a lot and we played some big concerts, but we've never really been a big hit band. And that situation that of having a record label putting pressure on you to write a hit. I would love that. I would really, to me, that's the one kind of fantasy situation that, that our group have never really been through. Because I love all, you know, I love those big hits from the 70s and 80s. I love those big artists.
Yeah,
and
okay.
we're still quite a cult band, quite an underground band in some regards and in a lot of regards. And so that kind of, pressure to write, to follow up your big hit with another big hit.
that's the dream.
That is something that I really aspire to.
Well, Stuart, I want to skip forward a little bit to the movie God Help the Girl and what made you want to enter the world of directing a movie and what was the starting point of that project? You know, was this years of a thought, years in the making, or, you know, as was this an itch that you just always wanted to scratch? Because I must say, I remember watching it a few years ago and I absolutely loved it. Loved it. And then when you agreed to the interview, admittedly, I put it back on then last week to remind myself. And I loved it just as much. Like, it's really, I can't even put my finger on it, but it's just a really nice feel good. You know, the music's brilliant. The choreography is super. And I just, you know, the second it was over, I just wanted to pick up the phone and call you there and then to say, you know, what was the whole experience like?
I didn't really realize that I didn't have a big inclination to make a film. It was kind of a little bit like the band. It just happened. But the band had been going for 10 years, and I remember I was out for a run in Sheffield, and you know, we had a show the next day, and I got that song in my head, which was God Help the Girl, the first tune. And it's for the first time, I almost heard it complete, but it was a woman singing it. It was a girl singing it, and it was a 60s sound, and I loved it. So I got back to, I carried a little pencil around with me when I went running, and I
so you heard all that in your head, Stuart? Was it, you heard?
Yeah, I heard the whole song. God Help the Girl, blah, blah, blah. Just like a really nice pop song, just while I was out running. Sometimes, you know, when you're doing something like running or walking or something that's, you know, a little bit rhythmic or almost hypnotic, when you forget yourself, that's when you get your best ideas. And so that came to me. And then I decided, well, that's not really for the group. And I kept my mind open, and the songs kept coming along with this same female voice. And then I realized it would be a record. And then soon after, I thought, well, you know, she's a real character in my head. I got the chance. Out. Yeah, I got the chance. I took a break from the group. I said to the group, look, we've been working for 10 years solid. And I remember finishing one tour and then sitting down on the Monday and starting to write the screenplay for the movie. And it was so much fun.
Just waiting for his phone call. I'll eat the chocolate hidden in the fridge. I'll pay his messages, analyze his intonation. Please stop me there, I'm even boring myself. I think of him when I'm doing the dishes. I build it up and then I turn him down. You have been warned, I'm born to be contrary. That word in school I wrote from right to left. Teacher never cared for me. Preacher said a prayer for me. God help the girl, she needs all the help she can. Thank you.
So Stuart, this whole podcast is about creativity, and here we are talking to an extremely successful songwriter, performer, recording artist, director. The artwork of Belle and Sebastian is something I want to come back to later, because I always feel it's something that really is striking and stands out. But before we leave the movie, was there anything that you felt when you finished that process that, you know, did you feel that you wanted to do it again, or did you feel that was a good note to leave it on?
It was a long process.
Okay.
You know, we made the record first, and that was a whole thing. And then, you know, I had to work really hard, build the script up. I fell in with a producer, and raising the money to make that film took a long time, and then casting it. The whole thing took years. And was
that a surprise for you, Stuart? I mean, did you sort of feel at that stage that you had written so many records that it was going to be similar enough process to making a movie?
Maybe. I had no clue. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, doing it for the first time, every stage was interesting to me.
Sure.
I think we wasted a lot of time and money in the early days. Like, because we made that a group. You know, we had a whole group, and we actually toured the girl group, and we wow. auditioned so many people, and it was fun, but I would go straight to the finishing line this time, you know, and if I was to do it again. But you learn so much. Where are you going to learn that? You know, where are you going to learn to make a movie, a musical movie, an original musical movie with all your songs? Nobody's going to teach you to do that. You can only learn it by
jumping
by doing it. So of course it was a 5-year, 6-year slog, apprenticeship, whatever you like to call it, but it was still worth it.
Well, it was a fantastic end product. Would you do it again?
I would do it again. I would need to wait for a good inspiration. I mean, I'm writing a book just now. Like, I started last year and talking about some of those earlier years that we were chatting about earlier.
Great.
The start of the 90s before the group got together. And it strikes me that if I get that book out, that if there was ever a script made of it, I would quite like to direct that film. You know, that
brilliant.
Would be
great.
And I'm not, that's coming from different direction. The God Help the Girl was built around songs, and this is built around, it's more autobiographical, and
sure.
I wouldn't plan it to be a musical at this point, but then there's obviously going to be music in it.
Yes.
So
yeah, of course.
So that would be, so that's something for the, you know, for the, a few years hence.
Brilliant.
If anybody's interested.
You heard it here first. You know, this is the starting point, hopefully. One last question about God Help the Girl. Had you ever imagined putting it on stage?
Every 6 months, somebody asked me it's somebody asked me just a couple of days ago if they could put God Help the Girl on stage, and I always say yes.
Brilliant.
and I think sometimes it's happened in smaller amateur productions. It's happened in the States somewhere, but the Citizens company was game for doing God Help the Girl. And I was quite far down the line with a young scriptwriter, and you know, we were going to ramp it up somewhat, and I was very encouraging. But then the sits was they started renovating it, and it sort of fell by the wayside. So but like I say, somebody in, it was Reading or Bristol, just asked me just a few days ago. So,
we can start putting the pressure on.
Yeah, I have no interest myself in putting it on stage, because I was more in love with film, and
sure.
But I would encourage them to do it. I'd encourage them to look at the script again, and maybe, you know, they could adapt it for stage.
Okay, so you'd leave that little bit of room for creative input.
Oh, you have to, yeah, definitely, because it's a very different format. I don't know anything about theatre.
I mean,
you know, something to bear in mind with, you know, for people watching this who are who are creative is that you should never make your mind up about something completely. You know, you should never keep your mind closed to something. You have to realize that the creative process is it's a lump of clay that's always changing, and that you could miss something if you become too stubborn about it. Often the best things happen with collaboration. You know, so even if you're working on something, but and then when you get in the room with people and you realize, wow, that's a better idea, or that, you know, you should use those ideas. You shouldn't be shy.
That's some really good advice, Stuart. And you know, one of the things we're hoping with this podcast is that especially people who are at the early stages of their creative journeys can take some lessons to note from this. So you know, I think that's, you couldn't have asked for better advice. As I mentioned there, in terms of the artwork that you typically put out there, or the covers of your albums, I mean, it always looks like there's a huge amount of thought that goes into it. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Oh, sometimes there is, and then sometimes when I'm tired after making a record, then it varies.
Yeah, you're lucky. I just throw anything on it.
Yeah, yeah. It really, really varies. Sometimes I just want to maybe ask a friend of my wife's and we'll do the pictures a couple of hours. And then sometimes it's a 2-day, a 3-day kind of adventure. Like I did a shoot with my wife and her two friends once that they pretended to be like models for the Scottish Tourist Board. And we went all over Scotland taking these funny pictures of them looking bored.
And, brilliant.
You know, sometimes it has its own little story.
Well, Stuart, you've been so generous of your time. I really appreciate you joining us for this podcast. We've just got one or two more questions before we finish up, if that's all right. And I want to go back to music, because one of the things I'm really interested about is some people just absolutely love being in a studio, that they get excited about going in and that's where the magic happens. And it's kind of like the touring is just then almost like a lap of honor of what they did in the studio, while other people just can't wait to get on stage and get an audience in front of them. And do you find any of those environments to be your real home, or do you just take each stage as they come and enjoy each part?
I think I think for us, live music is, when we started, I had no inclination to really play live. You know, I never imagined we'd be a live band, but the whole thing is tipped in almost in favor of the live experience in the past 10 years. And it's just become so enjoyable as the bands become, you know, played together for longer, and the, you know, the crowds have sort of grown up with us. So we're very lucky. It's a little bit yin and yang. When you're done in the studio, you're ready to get out there. And then when you're done with the tour, you're ready to get back
yes,
in.
Yes, yeah, yeah. You exhaust each stage until you're ready to move on to the next.
Yeah, and then it always seems sort of fresh.
Of course.
Sometimes I wish, you know, you wish that you didn't feel the need to get into absolutely every aspect of the so-called work, because, you know, even this time around when we put out the live record, our management asked us to prepare visuals for every single track, like 20, wow, 23 tracks. And because they said, you know, it's good to be on YouTube these days. And they said, you know, we'll just, we've got these editors in London. We'll just ask them to get this together. And then we were thinking, well, yeah, but what are they actually getting together? What are they editing?
Yeah.
This is like representing our group. This
yeah,
is like,
yeah, yeah, of know, course.
I can't help it. If our track is going to be represented on YouTube with visuals or a video, it's got to be half decent.
Oh no, yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
I spent the last, you know, 2 or 3 months, and I didn't mean to, with, you know, working with the editors and running around taking footage on my phone and digging up old archive footage. And
oh my god,
it's been fun, but
I'd say that was some tedious task.
Yeah, sometimes you could do without it.
But you are right, because, you know, you work so hard as a musician to try and paint this picture and give off a vibe through a song, that the imagery is as important then to give off the same impression of what you were trying to do with the music.
Yeah. I mean, we could have simply said no.
Oh yeah, true.
That's,
yeah.
Well, that's an option. So it's not, it's nobody's fault except my own. But
Of course. Do you ever find, I know from going back to my time with Celtic Thunder that whenever we'd record an album before bringing the album on tour, you would then sing the song X amount of times on tour, and it was when you'd sung it so many times. At the end of the tour, you felt, when you heard your original album version, you thought, oh God, I'd love to go back into the studio and re-record it now. You know, now that I've sung it so many times, I feel like I'm in a different headspace with that same song. Do you ever feel that yourself, that you wrap up a tour and you just want to almost go back into the studio to re-record the same material?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. That's and which is, so it's funny you asked me that question on the day that our first proper live LP is announced, because I do feel that we're righting a few wrongs, or yes. I'm very happy with some of the versions of the songs. I would suggest that they were definitive, except, you know, I mean, it's up to the audience really, but some of these songs that are 25 years that we recorded 25 years ago, I just feel that they're much nicer on this. They're more robust, they're warmer, even more feeling. So there's nothing really you could do about that. But there's no law. You can always go back and re-record something if you feel like it.
And then take that on tour afterwards. Yeah. But Stuart, it's been an absolute pleasure having a chat. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the work that you've done, and is there anything that you would throughout, I mean, you've done so much now, but is there anything that you would suggest to any, if there's any teenager listening or anyone who's at the very beginning of their creative journey and having listened to this and thinking, you know, what has Stuart Murdoch done that I can try and emulate? Or is there anything that you would recommend to that person, or to a 16, 17 year old Stuart Murdoch, if you were listening to yourself? You know, if you've done a bit of writing as well, maybe you've possibly thought about this or you know, been a bit more nostalgic. But is there anything that you would recommend to yourself?
Well, I'd probably just repeat the sort of thing that I said before about having the confidence to stick with this thing that you have, even though everybody around you seems to be moving in a different direction or being discouraging. If you know that you have a thing that you're very keen on, even if it feels outlandish or weird, stick with it. You know, keep working it, and you know, you'll get some, hopefully you'll get some luck at some point. But that's the main thing with creativity. It's so enjoyable. It doesn't matter if you're just, you know, painting a picture in your kitchen, or you're playing to 20,000 people in Glasgow Green. It's almost a similar thing. I wouldn't say that one is more valid or more enjoyable than the other thing. The doing a painting in your kitchen could just be as affecting.
Well, what a brilliant note to leave on. Stuart, thank you so much for taking the time out to chat with us here on the Create Podcast. We're absolutely really looking forward to getting our hands on your brand new copy, Bell and Sebastian's double album, What to Look For in Summer, this December 11th. But you've given some really, really valid and useful pointers for anyone at any level of their creative journey. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks, Cole.
It has been an absolute pleasure welcoming Stuart Murdoch onto the Create Podcast, and we want to thank him for taking the time out to chat and also for giving us access to preview one of the tracks from Bell and Sebastian's upcoming album, What to Look For in Summer, released this December 11th. Here's a preview of one of the tracks from the album, which happens to be one of my all-time favourites, The Boy with the Arab Strap. See you next Thursday the 12th for episode 3 as we chat with award-winning country singer Nathan Carter. See you then, folks. It's a long time to pass you by. Day upon day of this wonder and get you down. Nobody gives you a chance or a dollar in this old town.
you is a giveaway. It's for a response, not your style. I don't like this place, we better go. Then I compare notes with your older sister. I am a lazy cat, she is as pure as a cold dripping snow. Isolation. I missed the bus. You were there on your back with the boy with the Arab strap. With the boy with the Arab strap. Recorders. The Asian man with his loving affair with his racist president. A central location for you is a must, that you stagger about making free with your lewd and lascivious foes. We all know you're soft cause we've all seen you dancing. We all know you're hot. Drinking from noon until noon again. You're the boy with the filthy laugh. You're the boy with the Arab strap. From the shelter shop, comments aloud, but she takes the back seat as a cigarette catches and sets off the smoke alarm. What did you make of the cool set in London? You're constantly updating your hit parade of your 10 biggest wines. Come down, everyone. She's got style, but don't fall off. Sunday bath time could take a while. She's got... Sorry, excuse me, sir. Sunday bath time could take a while. Just want to see what everybody looks like. She's got style. Sunday bath time could take a while. Better. She's got style, so much style, too much style. She was too good for me. She worked as a waitress, but she had a rich daddy. She was slumming it, I wrote her a note, I said, dear catastrophe waitress. She's got stuff. She never wrote me back, she got fired that week. But that's the way things go, it's bittersweet. We got this song at least. And it's called The Boy with the Arab Strap.